From the Land Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the Closing Market Report. It is the 13th day of April, 2023. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. Coming up in this half hour, we'll talk about the commodity markets with Matt Bennett. He's at agmarket.net. Kelly Astis will be here to talk about true army worm and black cutworm flights into the state and her need to have some help in monitoring those flights. You, as a producer out in the field, can help out by posting some pheromone traps. We'll hear more about that. And then as we close out our time together, we'll talk about the weather forecast. By the way, those pests, they come in on some of these storms, so we'll monitor those and discuss what the weather really is going to look like over the next week with Mike Tenura. He's at T-Storm Weather, found online at tstorm.net. We'll do that all on this Thursday edition of the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media. It is public radio for the farming world.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
May corn at $6.52 and a quarter, finished 3 3/4 lower for the day. July contract at $6.25 and a half. It finished down 2 1/4 for the afternoon. And December futures at $5.53 and 3/4, a penny and 3/4 lower. May beans at $15.01, down 3 1/4. July up 1 at $14.73 and a quarter. November soybeans at $13.12 and a half. 4 3/4 higher. The bean meal up $3.40. The bean oil for the day 28 cents lower. Wheat futures soft red 11 lower at $6.76. The hard red and the July contract today 31 1/4, down 15 cents. Live cattle futures finished at $164.50, down 35. Feeder 77 1/2 lower, 207.80. And the lean hogs at $85.65, down $1.90. Crude oil about 88 cents lower at $82.38 a barrel. Diesel fuel or heating oil is 2.5 cents lower at $2.67 and 7 tenths. And gasoline on the wholesale price per gallon down 3 7 tenths at $2.83 and a half per gallon. We're now joined by Matt Bennett, agmarket.net, who is in the field like many planting this afternoon. Are you doing corn or soybeans today, by the way, Matt?
Personally, I'm planting corn. We got someone that's planting soybeans as well. So we're kind of going at it from two angles right now. Ground's working awfully nice, so we just decided we'd, get after it with both rigs. So I have enough help. I would say that we're not long on help, but I've got enough help for the time being. So
farmers across southern Illinois, the central part of the state, eastern Illinois, as of yesterday, really did start to move. Although producers that are in parts of Iowa, certainly in the Dakotas and Minnesota, have yet to begin. Has the marketplace just offsetting each of those parts of the Corn Belt?
Yeah, I mean, essentially, you said a lot there. So I definitely are seeing a lot of planters going in my part of the world, okay? And I feel like where people are running, they're giving it everything they've got. So I think there'll be areas quite frankly, are going to get done planting corn this week. I know that sounds crazy, but I'm just saying certain individuals, because I do know that a handful of my neighbors have been talking about, within the next few days, they'd be wrapping up. So there's a ton of progress being made. But at the same time, you've got situation, of course, in North Dakota, Minnesota, and in parts of South Dakota, where they've got significant issues, with snowpack that's trying to melt. So now they're in a flooding situation. They're not going to be able to plant anytime soon. And so, I think what it's going to boil down to is what's the weather going to do? What's Mother Nature going to deal them? And so if we don't have any prevent plant, which is what the USDA is pretty much assuming based upon their acreage figures, then I think that it changes the scope of the discussion. But if they do have prevent plant, obviously, it's going to change things around, especially with how thin we're running on carryout. So all eyes are on the upper Midwest and northern plains right now, because we all know that the Midwest can get this thing planted very quickly in this part of the world.
What are the things that have been playing in the marketplace that you have watched fundamentally this week or on the charts?
A couple of things come to mind. I mean, before today, actually, we've seen incredible bull spreading action. As far as corn and beans were concerned, but whenever you look at the May, the July, now a lot of folks called me this morning and said, hold on, my basis changed big time overnight. They took a ton of basis away, but cash price didn't change much. I said, yeah, everyone switching over to bid and versus in July. And so, you know, there's a lot that's moving around at this stage of the game, but this bull spreading action, I think, is something that could continue, you know, possibly even into that May report. But essentially what we're seeing is extremely tight situation, especially in certain regions of the U.S. whenever it comes to cash, both corn and beans, whereas I think there's a little bit less concern about what the stocks might look like as far as new crop, especially, you know, whenever you have planters rolling. So typically when you have planters rolling, you're going to have, I guess, a little bit more pressure on the market. And that's kind of what we're seeing whenever we look over towards our new crop contracts.
What are your expectations for that May WASDE report? And, of course, the first USDA look in the supply and demand figures for the 2023-24 growing season of the crop you're now putting in the ground.
Well, I think that when it gets right down to it, you're going to have a much less burdensome situation, if you will, tight situation, you know, on corn. Are you going to see a 2 billion carry? That's possible. I don't know that we're going to be able to get quite that high. The USDA is likely going to use that 181.5. So keep in mind that they're probably going to use 92 and 181.5. But I'd like to see what they're going to do as far as carry out is concerned on old crop, which will translate to carry in on new crop. I was quite surprised this week, you know, that we really didn't get any sort of revision whatsoever, especially after we looked at the quarterly stock situation, essentially fooling everyone, showing less stocks of both corn and beans than what most people thought. So, you know, I think when it gets right down to it, there's going to be a lot of different things to look at. But from my vantage point, I'm going to be watching closely to kind of see, you know, what are they going to do as far as demand, as far as the old crop situation is concerned, and then what are they going to do as far as demand on new crop, because there's a lot of questions to be answered there.
Is there any reason to believe that the USDA will notch down the ending stocks, given that they didn't this month? I can't imagine why they might next month. Or is it just that they are of a mind that usage is just ticking down because of the high price?
That's a really good question. In all honesty, you know, the whole trade, you know, we all learned quite a bit between the March intentions in quarterly stocks report versus April. I mean, the thing is that we all felt confidently whenever we ran our balance sheet, whenever we ran numbers, carryouts, if you will, you know, that stocks would be more than the USDA came up with them coming up with, you know, 60, 70 lower as far as corn's concerned. You had to have thought that there was going to at least be some sort of revision. Now, we weren't looking for a 70 million bushel revision lower on any stocks, but we felt like you could see anywhere from 25 to 40 on this particular report, you know, and then any further revisions probably would be made, you know, whenever you get out towards the June quarterly stocks report and you get a really good idea of what usage looked like between March and June. So, you know, I don't know. It'll be interesting to see how it plays out. But I do expect that you'll see some revisions in that May report. I felt like on the April report, they more or less punted. Now, it was very interesting to see that they dropped Argentine soy production, you know, another 6 million metric ton. I mean, if you're keeping track, that's 14 over the course of 2 months, and that 14 million metric ton is essentially going to come out of Brazil. We all know that, and that means that 14 million metric ton is going to be going to Argentina instead of one of its normal destinations. That's not such a bad thing for the U.S. producer.
Hey, thanks much. We'll talk with you again this afternoon for Commodity Week.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Matt Bennett is with AgMarket.net. He joined us here on the Closing Market Report. It comes to you from Illinois Public Media. It is public radio for the farming world. You can listen on demand anytime you'd like at WILLAG.org. Up next, today's agricultural news. In Washington, D.C. this week, the Biden administration made a new proposal with the toughest auto emission rules ever, which should accelerate the transformation of the U.S. auto industry and possibly just as swiftly curtail ethanol use in vehicles. The proposal, starting with the 2027 model year, could lead to 3/4 of light-duty vehicles being electric by 2032. That's a big change from what President Biden told the industry to plan for, which was 50% EVs by 2030. Renewable Fuels Association head Jeff Cooper accuses the Biden EPA of picking winners and losers.
It does it through the assumption that EVs are carbon-free vehicles, and everything else, any vehicle with an internal combustion engine, they are assuming that there's a fair amount of tailpipe emissions coming out the tailpipe for those vehicles.
Instead, Cooper argues for a technology-neutral, science-based approach to reducing carbon emissions.
We know that 60% of the electricity produced in this country today still comes from fossil fuels, coal and natural gas, and less than 20% comes from renewable resources. So yes, electric vehicles have a carbon impact, and in many cases, the carbon emissions impact of an electric vehicle is really no better than what you get with a conventional internal combustion engine.
And Cooper made note of a Washington Post report that the proposal may backfire with the auto industry over the time and cost to build new assembly lines, re-engineer vehicles, make them affordable, and await enough charging stations to be developed.
The grid is not ready for that. The recharging infrastructure is not anywhere close to being ready for that, and the manufacturers are not ready to produce that volume of electric vehicles. But not only that, are consumers ready, and do consumers want these vehicles?
Jeff Cooper says the RFA, Renewable Fuels Association, is asking EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, to reconsider its proposal, adding, "All we are asking for is a level playing field." Well, the U.S. District Court of North Dakota has issued a preliminary injunction against the Biden administration from implementing its final rule defining the waters of the U.S. in 24 states, otherwise known as WOTUS. The court's move comes in response to a motion filed by Montana Attorney General Austin Knutson. According to the Montana Farm Bureau Federation, estimates from the similar Obama-era rule would have placed nearly 90% of Montana's land under the jurisdiction of EPA. The injunction resulting from our lawsuit, Knutson says, is welcome relief to farmers and ranchers and workers in mining, energy, and other industries. Knutson also says he will continue to fight the Biden administration and prevent them from claiming federal jurisdiction over massive swaths of land and water. And finally, USDA's Foreign Ag Service, or FAS, issued its Grain World Markets and Trade Report, and it says China is now the biggest wheat importer in the world. The report says China's wheat imports are forecast up to 12 million metric tons this year. That's the country's highest level of imports since the mid-1990s, when imports for wheat it totaled 12.5 million metric tons. And that's a look at today's agricultural news. Each growing season, with your help, the University of Illinois keeps track of insect pest blights into the state and then calculates when those insect pests might be doing damage in your fields. Pests like the black cutworm, the army worm, corn earworm, and, of course, the European corn borer are monitored in pheromone traps. Kelly Estes coordinates the Illinois Pest Monitoring Network, and she needs some help, especially in southern Illinois, some volunteers, and in central Illinois. She has the reasons why it's important and what it means to the farmers across the state as they're trying to keep track of these insect pests and when they might do damage in their fields.
So spring has arrived and the sun is shining. Field work is commencing in several areas of the state, and we're starting to see some of our spring pests start to show up too. Each year here at the U of I, we operate an insect trapping network, thanks in part to funding provided by USDA as part of a NIFA grant, and also as a result of several volunteers across the state of Illinois. Each spring, several of our crop pests migrate north, and this includes black cutworm and true army worm. These are two of our earliest insect pests of corn here in Illinois. We also will see true army worm affecting our wheat crop potentially as well. By utilizing our trapping network, we use pheromone traps that are set across the state, and it helps us gauge when moths are not only arriving, but also when they could be a direct threat to our emerging crops. The traps give us an indication of presence in a certain area, but also what the potential pest population might be in the coming weeks based on those numbers of moths found in traps. For example, we've had several reports of true armyworm moths in traps this past week. A storm brought in several in the western part of the state over the weekend. Pike County, also Hancock County, I know we had as many as 40 moths captured in a trap over Easter weekend over there. But over the course of those same nights, we had 157 true armyworm moths caught here in Pike County. So different parts of the state are going to see different moth flights during the spring, and this could result in different insect pressures as well. So monitoring becomes important because it can help predict when we might see insect injury. We're also monitoring for black cutworm adults. This gives us, again, an indication of moths that are in an area when they're arriving. But with black cutworm, we're also looking for specifically when a significant flight might occur. A significant flight is defined as 8 or more moths caught over a 2-day span. When we have that significant flight, we can predict when black cutworm larvae would be in the field and potentially cutting plants. So when we have someone report a significant flight, we then use degree days to help predict insect development. So let's put this to use. We also had a significant black cutworm flight this past weekend in Pike County. And this was the first of the year. Traps have been out just here 2 weeks in many areas. By using degree days, we're predicting that moths in that area will mate, lay eggs, and the development of those larvae through different instars is going to occur. The degree day calculator lets us predict that around May 18th, the larvae will be big enough to be cutting corn plants in that area. So the trapping really helps us to know not only what's going on, but also helps us focus in on scouting particular areas in the coming weeks. The network has been around for many, many years. And as I mentioned, it operates through the use of volunteers. While we have several cooperators lined up and traps are out and moths are coming, we're still looking to fill some gaps across the state. Southern Illinois comes to mind, particularly south of I-70. Also, Central Illinois, right smack dab in the heart of the state, counties like Sangamon or Christian, for example, we don't have any traps. But honestly, don't let location stop you. If you're interested in monitoring, I still do have traps and lures that I can send out if you are interested in monitoring black cutworm or true armyworm moths this spring. Feel free to drop me an email at kcook8@illinois.edu if you're interested. And all that we really ask is that cooperators send in their weekly trap counts to me so that we can summarize them and really get the information out to people across the state.
By the way, the pheromone traps, Kelly Estes is talking about farmers putting in their fields and then sending the data back to her, are pretty easy to use. The pheromones are specific to the insect pest, so you don't have to really worry about having a lot of insects to count. And as you heard, the counts aren't generally that high. If you'd like to participate, you can contact Kelly Estes. The email address for her is kcook8@illinois.edu. That's K for Kelly, Cook, C-O-O-K, 8, the number, at illinois.edu. Or you can just email me. You can find that email address at willag.org, and I'll forward your note on to Kelly. Let's turn our attention now to the weather forecast. Mike Tenor is here from T-Storm Weather. Thank you much, Mike. You can find Mike, of course, at tstorm.net online. Yesterday, I was traveling a bit in the morning. Not so many farmers in the field with planters, at least. Anything else, for that matter. And then in the afternoon, things really began to move. And by the time 6 o'clock turned around, I think almost everybody in our part of the world was going. Temperatures have been warm. Can you tell me about those conditions and the planters rolling?
Well, yesterday was unbelievable from a temperature standpoint. We had highs in the mid-80s to mid-90s across much of the Corn Belt. And the interesting about it was that the warmest weather was actually in the central and northern growing areas. That included much of Nebraska, Iowa, even South Dakota and Minnesota reached the 90s. So that warm weather is going to stick around for a couple more days. But once they get into the weekend, it'll start to cool off. And beyond then, temperatures will bounce around between some nice and mild days and some cool days. But it won't be as nearly as warm as this, at least not for another couple of weeks, because this is just an anomaly and it's not going to last for much longer.
An anomaly, when we change back to cooler temperatures, does it come back? Does it come with rainfall?
Well, we'll certainly see rain chances as we move into next week and beyond. There's several systems that will start to move across the central U.S. from the middle of next week forward. And there is a number of large systems that are looming to the west, but there's a lot of uncertainty with each one of these. The biggest problem that we have is that the first system that moves across the United States over the course of Monday through Friday next week, that one will affect the paths of the ones that follow. And there's just too much uncertainty with that first system to understand exactly how it's going to move. And until we get a good handle on that, we won't have much clue as to what will follow more than 7 to 10 days out. So a lot rides on this first system that's going to move across the United States next week. And we think it will bring some rain to different parts of the central U.S. with the best overall chance in the eastern plains and in the western Corn Belt. So say west of the Mississippi River and then east of Dodge City, Kansas.
And so you're telling me the first system's really going to set the pattern for a bit, I take it.
Yeah, that's the way it looks now. And it's just because we can see there's a number of systems out there. But if that first one moves through real quickly, maybe that will dislodge some cool air and then prevent the other ones from passing. On the other hand, if it moves more slowly, then the next one will be able to move through slowly as well. And slow systems in April and May are how you get your decent rain events.
From a climate perspective, can you talk a little bit in the Midwest about frost and freeze dates and when the last ones are in different parts of the Corn Belt?
Well, yeah, let's just focus on central Illinois. Essentially, a 75 to 100-mile circle centered on Decatur would show you that over the last 35 years or so, starting in 1986, the latest freeze we ever had in the spring, where a temperature in that circle would average under 28 degrees Fahrenheit, the latest date was April 17th. So we know it's going to be real mild here over the next few days, and we know we're not going to have a freeze at least in the next week or so. So more than likely, the freeze of the has already happened. We're not going to see another major freeze going forward. As far as frost, though, where it's 32 degrees or colder, that date shifts all the way out to May 9th. So another 3 to 4 weeks till you're totally free of that frost risk. And so that will be a challenge going forward. But at this point in time, even though temperatures will be bouncing around a lot once we get beyond Friday and Saturday, you know, there's no real reason to start thinking that we have some anomalous event coming up. Sure, it is going to be colder at times and even much colder, especially when you compare it to how warm it is today. But as far as a killing event or something like that, the killing event threat is pretty much over. But you'll still have that low threat of a frost all the way into the first, say, 7 to 10 days of May.
Hey, thank you much.
Yep, great being here.
That's Mike Tenera. He is with T-Storm Weather at tstorm.net. Online, you've been listening to the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Medium. It is public radio for the farming world.